The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. If there's one down ballot statewide race that has engendered a lot of attention and is attracting even more money, it's the GOP contest to become the next Attorney General. That's because Will Scharf is challenging incumbent Attorney General Andrew Bailey, who was appointed to his post by Governor Mike Parson. Scharf, a St. Louis County attorney, joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about why he would do a better job than Bailey and some of his priorities if he wins election to the post later this year. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum, joining me from beautiful mid-Missouri. She covers all things state government and state politics for St. Louis Public Radio.
Sarah Kellogg.
And joining us in studio, he is one of two Republicans seeking to be Missouri's Attorney General.
Will Scharf.
This is a very competitive race, and we're very happy to have you on so we can talk about how you would change the office and sort of some of your priorities. But before we do that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in Missouri politics.
Sure. So I've never run for office before. This is a really new experience for me. My background is as a constitutional attorney. As many of your listeners probably know, I'm currently on President Trump's legal team. I've been an appellate attorney for him for almost a year now. We've represented him in courtrooms across America, including most notably at the U.S. Supreme Court on a number of matters. Before that, before I started running, I was a federal violent crimes prosecutor here in St. Louis, assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Missouri attached to the violent crime unit in that office. In that capacity, I prosecuted fentanyl dealers, armed robbers, carjackers, bank robbers. We did gang interdiction work. I did fugitive apprehension work with the U.S. Marshals Service. It was really an incredible experience that brought me really to the front lines of the battle against violent crime here in the region. Before that, I was a conservative activist. Probably most notably during the Trump administration, I worked on judicial confirmations and nominations. I was on the teams that worked to confirm Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, got them across the finish line, got them on the U.S. Supreme Court. So I have a mixture of experiences, but running for office, I never really thought this was something that I would do. And then a couple years ago, the opportunity came up. Friends of mine approached me about running. Said that they thought it was really time to shake up Jefferson City and get more conservative outsiders as opposed to establishment politicians and establishment people into office. And that's really that's how this whole thing started.
You are the lone primary opponent of Attorney General Andrew Bailey. Why do you not think that he deserves another 4 years in office?
Well, look, I think Governor Parson made his choice. And I think the people of Missouri deserve a say as well. As we've gotten around the state, I mean, we've driven over 45,000 miles. We've been to every corner of the state. We've met with conservatives from small towns to big cities, really just everywhere. I haven't heard a single person say that they think Jefferson City is doing a great job. I think Andrew Bailey is a creature of the Jefferson City establishment. He's being backed by all the lobbyists and all the special interests and all the folks who really run that city. I think the people of Missouri deserve and need a voice, especially in an office as powerful and as important as the Attorney General's office. And to me, that's the core contrast in this race, continuity in Jefferson City. Or a break from that. And I think that that's the message that's really resonating with Missouri Republican primary voters.
As you mentioned, you've been an attorney for former President Trump. We'll get to some of that in a bit, but I have a question. If you win and he wins, will you not be able to stand up to him in the legal arena if he does something that is clearly harmful to Missouri or the rest of the country?
Well, look, my responsibility as Attorney General is to the people of Missouri. I'll swear an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the state of Missouri, and my job is enforcing Missouri law. I don't think there's a conflict there. I've got a great relationship with President Trump. We've done good work representing him, but once I'm in office, my responsibility is to the Constitution of the state of Missouri and the U.S. Constitution. I'd also say that having that relationship with him, to the extent that there is conflict between Missouri and the federal government, I'd hope that that would be beneficial, that I could get on the phone with him, get on the phone with his top advisors, and help the state of Missouri that way.
So as a constitutional attorney, if he... I'm not saying he's going to do this, but if he announces 2 years into his term, like, I'm going to run for a third term, you would be like, nope, Constitution says you're limited to two terms. You can't do that, Mr. President.
You know, the funny thing is that since Donald Trump first came on the scene in 2015 and 2016, we've heard this constantly from folks on the left, that Donald Trump is a quote-unquote threat to democracy, that he's going to undermine the Constitution, that he's going to undermine the constitutional order. I think we've seen so much of that from the Biden administration in the last couple of years that we just didn't see under President Trump. Biden's open defiance of the U.S. Supreme Court, obviously the campaign of lawfare against President Trump, which I've been on the front lines of fighting. I think the left likes to project onto President Trump all of these sort of evil things, and none of it's actually there. I think he was a tremendously successful president last time around. I think he's going to get reelected, and I think he's going to do a great job.
This race is expected to be quite expensive and quite contentious. A PAC that's supporting your campaign has taken in millions of dollars to attack Bailey, mainly from groups linked to people like Leonard Leo. What would you say to people who are put off by these groups' involvement?
Well, look, I think I'm backed by big national conservative groups that are as sick and tired with Jefferson City as Missouri Republican primary voters are. Missouri is this deep, deep red state. It voted for President Trump by 19 points. Yet on issue after issue after issue, we have failed to get real conservative policy done in this state. We don't look like Florida. We don't look like Texas. We don't even look like Tennessee or Arkansas or near neighbors, which are just governed much better in a much more positive conservative way than Missouri has been. So there's a lot of frustration with Jefferson City, both here in the state and around the country. I'd say this, though, you know, you mentioned my support. My opponent's support is the real scandal in this race. He's taken money from trial lawyers who have cases pending against his office. He had a fundraiser hosted for him by a marijuana dealer under investigation by the state. He took money from the illegal slot machine companies and their lobbyists, and then immediately turned around and pulled his office out of pending litigation against them. I think on issue after issue after issue, we've seen how campaign finance has corrupted the Missouri Attorney General's office. And I think the people of Missouri hate that sort of thing, justifiably so, and are going to reject it at the ballot box this August.
So there has been a lot of discourse against you. Andrew Bailey and his campaign have called you Wall Street Willie. I guess that's alliterative, perhaps. Not only to play up the fact that you're from New York, but you also come from a wealthy family. Now, both of these things are indisputably true, and they're things you can't really change. But is this type of attack going to be hurtful to your chances of winning the attorney generalship?
I think we've entered silly season, and I think Bailey and his team are desperate to avoid talking about his actual record in office and his many failings as attorney general. So instead, they're launching these sort of baseless personal attacks on me. I mean, I was born in New York. I was born there for the simple reason that that's where my parents happened to be living at the time. I really didn't have any control or say in that matter. My family's down in Florida. I moved to Missouri out of law school. I was expecting to be here for a year. I moved here to clerk for a federal appeals court judge, a guy named Ray Grunder, outstanding conservative judge. He was on Donald Trump's shortlist for the U.S. Supreme Court. And I just really liked Missouri. So I ended up settling here. Obviously, long before I got involved in politics, I was just a lawyer in private practice in St. Louis. This place is my home. I'm proud to be an adoptive Missourian. I can't really imagine living anywhere else. So if they want to attack me personally the way that they have been, you know, have fun, guys. I'm really looking forward to exposing aspects of Andrew Bailey's record that I think are far more relevant to this race and far more meaningful to the voters of Missouri.
You pointed out several times on this show that you're a conservative outsider and that you're trying to paint yourself as different from the Jefferson City quote-unquote swamp. But let's also mention that you used to work for the former governor as a policy director, and all these relationships that you've had with a lot of these conservative legal people we mentioned, couldn't it be seen that you may not be like part of the inside crowd that's currently in charge of Jefferson City, but you could be painted as a generalized insider from a national perspective?
A generalized insider? I just don't think that makes any sense, Jason.
Can I restate the question?
Well, let me just answer what I think you're getting at.
What I'm getting at is people are going to see your experience and think you're not a real outsider, that you're actually an insider in outsider's clothing.
Well, I just completely disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason that I've gotten the national profile that I have, the reason that I have the national support that I have, is because I've done very important things for the conservative movement, whether it's the work that I'm doing defending President Trump now or whether it's the work I did during the Trump administration on judicial confirmations in the U.S. Supreme Court. That's something that brings you into contact with people who are involved in politics and people who like investing in conservative causes. But the problem that this state faces, the thing that's dragged this state back for decades now, is this uniparty political establishment in Jefferson City that's deeply in hock to the special interests and the lobbyists who I believe are really in control in that city. And that's a world that I'm totally foreign to. It's a world that I have absolutely no accountability to. And I think the reason why Jefferson City is fighting as hard as it is against our campaign is because of the threat I pose and our campaign poses to the powers that be in Jefferson City. And I think to Missouri Republican voters, again, that's the key contrast in this race. Do you want to double down on Jefferson City or do you want to try something new?
Let's run through a number of things that Andrew Bailey has done in his tenure as Attorney General. One of the things that I think was particularly high profile was he filed a quo warranto to try to oust Kim Gardner from office. Now, some people, including me, were skeptical of this because the bar to remove an office holder is pretty high. And I will just add that she resigned. She was not ousted from office because of this quo warranto. But the AG's office did find evidence that she was taking nursing classes, and it seems that that probably would have broached the threshold to oust her. So my question is, do you think it was right for him to pursue that, and would you have pursued it in a different way?
So I think when you look at the effort against Kim Gardner, the AG's office played a big role. I think that's good. I think Auditor Scott Fitzpatrick also played a huge role. His investigation into Kim Gardner's office, I think, may have been the most threatening thing to her and may have been the thing that actually precipitated her resigning when she did. Likewise, the threat by City Judge Michael Noble to hold her in contempt and literally throw her in jail. I think all of these things played into getting Kim to resign, which is obviously a very good thing for St. Louis and a very good thing for the state. The bigger question, though, is why was Kim's reign of terror here in St. Louis allowed to continue for as long as it did? I mean, as of 2018, we knew that she was abjectly failing to do her job. There were any number of things that Jefferson City could have done. They could have stepped in. They could have done something about it. And instead, I think the folks in Jefferson City were just willing to let St. Louis burn to the ground rather than take on the difficult political task of figuring out a way to make sure that violent crime in the city was actually prosecuted. To me, that's just an abject failure of the political establishment in Jefferson City. And again, it all adds up to a very simple answer, which is that we need new leadership in this state.
Now, before we get to the next point, the people who were in office in the AG's office when Kim Gardner was in that period were Josh Hawley and Eric Schmidt. So you're saying that they failed to act as well?
I think the legislature could have passed any number of laws at any point, stripping Kim of her jurisdiction, establishing concurrent jurisdiction. They could have set up a special prosecutor's office. They could have merged the city and county prosecutor's offices. There were any number of things that they could have done. But because of a lack of leadership in Jefferson City, because of a lack of impetus to action, they just chose to do nothing. And to me, that's just the worst possible thing you can do when you're confronting a problem like violent crime in the city of St. Louis.
Well, the legislature actually did have a bill that was making its way and made it through the House, and it was slated to probably have momentum to go through the Senate that would have allowed the governor to appoint a special prosecutor, which would have tied the hands of Gardner. But after she resigned, it was pretty much a condition of that bill won't go forward if she resigns. So legislature did have policy that they were moving forward to, and probably, in my opinion, I think would have passed.
In 2023, not in 2018, not in 2019, not in 2020, not in 2021, not in 2022. It took Janae Edmondson, a poor girl from Tennessee, having basically her legs chopped off by a criminal who should have not been on the streets. This was this car crash in downtown St. Louis that was the real impetus to finally remove Kim from office. I mean, it shouldn't have taken that long. They could have stepped in and done something. There was a conscious choice made to do nothing. And you can call it, it's this sort of constant mantra of local control. I think what it really is that the folks in charge in Jefferson City, most of them are Republicans. The city doesn't really vote for them. They don't see this as a problem that they need to address. I think here in Missouri, we're all in this together. If our cities aren't successful, our rural areas aren't going to be successful, and vice versa. I think we need a state government that's focused on protecting the rights, the liberties, the prerogatives of all the people of Missouri. And I just don't think we have that in Jefferson City today.
Some gubernatorial candidates have talked about using the quo warranto process to oust what they see as, quote, liberal prosecutors. But how do you do that without steamrolling the concept of prosecutorial discretion?
Well, prosecutorial discretion is very important. A prosecutor has the right to bring a case or not bring a case. I think when you look at crime in general, when you look at the broader issue of crime, prosecutors need to be prosecuting violent crime. Kim's office, I mean, Kim was incompetent. She was unable to retain and manage staff. The situation that I saw from the ground level as a federal violent crime prosecutor in St. Louis was one of sheer and utter chaos on the streets. I mean, we had police officers bringing murderers and shooters to us and these terrible criminals to us for prosecution on, you know, relatively low-level federal gun and drug charges because they had no confidence that the more serious charges were going to be taken up and effectively prosecuted by the circuit attorney's office. To me, that's a situation that almost demanded state action. And yet again, we just didn't see that sort of concerted action by the state government until this whole thing blew up into national news in 2023. And to me, that's just not a way to govern the state.
One of the issues that both AG Bailey and AG Schmidt championed was around government censorship of social media activity. The Supreme Court just ruled that the plaintiffs challenging the ability of the federal government to cajole social media companies to delete material didn't have standing, and then it wasn't proven that these companies made the decision because of the government. Was this a misguided case?
Look, I think it's really disappointing that the Supreme Court ruled the way that it did. And I think this is another courtroom loss for the Bailey administration, which has lost a lot of very important cases in recent months, which I think speaks to the staffing problems they've had in that office. It speaks to the lack of effective leadership in that office. It's a real problem. I mean, Missouri v. Biden, Murthy v. Missouri, this was a very important First Amendment case. My opponent, Andrew Bailey, called it the most important First Amendment case in American history. And yet we have a loss instead of a win. You know, I've taken cases to the U.S. Supreme Court. We've won cases at the U.S. Supreme Court. I think we need an attorney general who's going to effectively represent Missouri's interests. And right now, I just don't think we have that.
What would you make of the argument that building a very tall wall curtailing the federal government from trying to get social media companies to delete content would make it impossible for them to try and remove dangerous activity? Like, for instance, someone falsely says there's no tornado warning when there is a tornado warning.
I don't think the federal government should be in the censorship business. I don't think it's the responsibility of the federal government to, for example, tell social media companies that they need to pummel any content that's talking about the lab leak theory of the origin of COVID in March and April of 2020, which now I think most people agree was true. When you look at what the Biden administration has done on the censorship front since taking office, it's a bold new world. I mean, this isn't something we've seen before in American history. And the social media companies are so powerful that the use the way that the federal government has comprehensively pressured them to basically steer people to a chosen point of view. I think it's un-American, and I think it's deeply violative of many people's First Amendment rights. I don't think that's a proper role for the government here.
But to piggyback on Sarah's point, when you're talking about something that is unquestionably untrue, like somebody saying on social media with, say, a million followers, hey, there's no tornado in St. Louis, and there is a tornado in St. Louis. Are you saying the government shouldn't have any power to say that tweet is wrong and it's not true? Are saying to Twitter or Facebook or whatever, take this down because it could get people potentially killed?
Well, first of all, that's not the situation that we're dealing with here.
I understand, but I'm asking in that specific instance.
I think the government has a right to speak. The government can certainly combat bad speech with good speech of its own. But again, I don't think the government should be engaging in censorship. I mean, when you look at the absolute core of the First Amendment, when you look at what the founders meant when they wrote the First Amendment, it's limitation on governmental prior restraint of speech. And I think that's really what this social media censorship campaign is about. It's preventing speech from being heard, preventing people from expressing their opinions on matters of tremendous public importance. And I just don't think that's a proper role for the government.
Staying on the free speech topic, if I may, another initiative that Bailey has pursued is trying to get documents from Media Matters, which is a left-wing, he doesn't think it's a media outlet, but they will claim that they're a media outlet that criticizes conservative media outlets. This is kind of piggybacking on another lawsuit that Elon Musk filed against Media Matters. And the articles were about how ads appeared in racist and anti-Semitic accounts. But like from reading the articles and reading even Elon Musk's brief, they're not arguing that the articles were false. They were just saying that it's very unlikely for this to happen. Based off your knowledge of, you know, libel law and free speech, was it misguided for Andrew Bailey to pursue this?
I think what we've seen consistently from Bailey since he took office is that every time there's an issue that's getting press, that's getting media, that's trending on Twitter, he inserts his office into that issue, usually quite clumsily, grabs a bunch of media attention, and then moves on to the next issue. So I'm very interested in what Media Matters is actually doing. I think there are a lot of these left-wing dark money nonprofits, many of which are operating in this state, that deserve serious investigation. I'm not sure if we're getting that sort of serious investigation out of the current AG's office.
One of the things that I brought up is Media Matters is based in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. has a shield law that makes it very difficult for the government to get documents from news outlets. He's arguing it's not a news outlet, but by that logic, I could say Gateway Pundit's not a news outlet, or some, you know, right-wing news outlet isn't a news outlet. Like, isn't that going to be a barrier to get any sort of documentation, regardless of whether you like that news outlet or not?
Well, when under Missouri law, when you have a nonprofit that's either raising money or spending money in this state, the attorney general does have some authority, both under Missouri nonprofit law, and also under the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act. There's pretty well-established case law on that front. So I'd fight the hypothetical there. I'd fight the question a little bit.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with Republican Attorney General candidate Will Scharf.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with Will Scharf. He is one of two Republicans seeking the nomination to be the Attorney General for Missouri. I want to move on to another thing that Andrew Bailey's administration did, and that was these 2023 emergency rules that placed pretty big restrictions on hormone therapy, puberty blockers, and gender transition surgery. These rules not only applied to minors, but also transgender adults. If you had been Attorney General, would you have tried to file these rules in the manner in which Bailey filed them?
Well, Bailey filed these rules and then got wrecked in court. He lost in both federal court and in state court on the same day and then ended up pulling the rules. Fortunately, the legislature stepped in. The legislature acted in a way that I think was entirely appropriate. I was fully supportive of to ban dangerous gender transition surgeries on minors. I'm very happy that the legislature did that. But again, when you look at the Bailey administration's actual record on this issue, it's courtroom failure. And I think Missourians are sick and tired of losing in court.
You are correct that, like, I believe that he lost because I think that the judges said he didn't have the right to do it. I think it was mainly on procedural grounds, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, he attempted to bring the case into federal court. He lost that. That was remanded back to the state court, and then he lost in state court.
Yeah. From a policy perspective, though, Do you think it was wrongheaded for Bailey to apply the rules to both minors and adults, especially when the legislature was primarily focusing their legislation on minors?
I think the policy case for restricting these sorts of interventions with minors is much stronger than it is for adults. But I do have serious concerns about the way that a lot of these procedures, a lot of these drugs are marketed, and the way that their side effects have been underreported, adverse events have been underreported. So I think there is room for more regulation on the adult side as well. But certainly to me, from a policy perspective, the case for intervention with respect to minors was very, very strong. And I'm glad the legislature stepped up and did what it did.
One of the things that was in the rules that caught my attention was it said that in order to receive hormone therapy or gender transition surgery, somebody, either a minor or an adult, would have to, quote, treat and resolve mental health disorders. Now, there are some mental health disorders that you cannot resolve. Like, you cannot resolve ADHD. You can take a stimulant to suppress the symptoms, but it will never go away. And I know this wasn't brought up in this case because it was struck down and they didn't pursue it further. But that seems like a pretty bright line equal protection issue to say that somebody with some sort of mental health disorder does not have a commingling at all with the health treatment can't get a health treatment. Can you address that point?
Well, I think one of the problems we've seen with the transgender care, particularly provided to minors, is you have young children who often have other mental issues. And instead of dealing with those underlying mental issues, they're being rushed down this path of gender transition, which is irreversible in most or many cases. And I think that's just wrong. I think in terms of establishing an appropriate standard of care, that's just not the way that these sorts of things should be treated, especially when such a large number of transgender youth who are allowed to proceed through puberty without going on puberty blockers, without taking hormones or going through surgery, end up not identifying. The data on this is quite clear from foreign countries and from America as well, end up not identifying as transgender by the time they conclude the puberty process. So I think there are a lot of issues here. I think the standards of care around treatment of people who identify as transgender need to be revised. And I think that's a process that's ongoing in countries around the world. I mean, we've seen England step back in a very major, decisive way from transgender intervention, particularly with minors. I think that's something America will end up doing as well and should.
I do want to point out with puberty blockers, a lot of times they're used for treating precocious puberty when you're seeing early onset puberty and, gosh, 3-4-year-olds, to which then they go off those and do begin puberty. So it is a pause button. I want you kind of to respond to that, and that it isn't something that couldn't be quote unquote reversible because it just pauses it.
That's the way that it's been portrayed. And you're talking about a very different medical case. When you look at the puberty blockers that are being prescribed to treat people who identify as being transgender, it's typically an off-label use, that there are not good studies showing that those sorts of interventions are in fact reversible. That's almost something that's been assumed by parts of the medical establishment without really the data to back that up. So I'd fight you a little bit on the facts there. I think that we're talking about two very different use cases of drugs that at the end of the day, we're talking about superdoses of hormones. This is not harmless medicine here. It's not like popping an Advil.
If you're elected to the AG's office, you could be asked to defend the law barring things like hormone therapy and puberty blockers for minors. Do you feel like this law will be able to survive an equal protection challenge?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an issue that's actually now poised to go before the Supreme Court. This is the Tennessee case. It's being the Tennessee law. It's being defended by my friend Jonathan Scarmetti, the Attorney General of Tennessee. I expect the Supreme Court will uphold that law, and I expect that they would similarly uphold Missouri's quite similar law.
If you are Attorney General, it's very possible that you could get sworn in after a measure legalizing abortion is placed in the Missouri Constitution. You will be asked to defend basically all of Missouri's abortion laws. Abortion rights opponents say the amendment is so expansive that all abortion laws in the state will ultimately get struck down. Are they right? And if so, is there anything you could do to preserve anything?
Yeah, I think the abortion measure that's going on the ballot is far broader than its supporters are claiming or admitting. I think that's a real problem. You know, I'm very pro-life. I've been involved in pro-life advocacy for most of my adult life. I've been endorsed by Missouri Right to Life in this case. I believe that we absolutely have to protect the innocent unborn, and that standing up for life is, it's core to who I am as a person. I will swear an oath to uphold Missouri law, to uphold the Missouri Constitution. We'll see how the chips fall in November. But I, for one, am deeply committed to beating that measure at the ballot. I hope Missouri does. I think it would be an outrage for that to end up in our Constitution.
And if that constitutional amendment doesn't pass and someone files a lawsuit trying to argue that in vitro fertilization is somehow unlawful, how would your office defend that?
Well, I don't think in vitro fertilization, I don't think there's anything in Missouri law that would make IVF illegal or inappropriate. I have a lot of friends who have, you know, conceived children through IVF. I think there's just nothing about Missouri law that really threatens or imperils IVF. I think there's a lot of kind of moral panic around this issue because of that. I think it was the decision down in Alabama a few months ago. But again, I don't see any risk to IVF in the state of Missouri, and I don't see how Missouri law really trenches on IVF at all.
Would you then be in support of any legislation that pretty much said that IVF would be protected in Missouri?
Well, I don't think we need that legislation because I don't think there's anything about Missouri law that really threatens or imperils IVF at all.
If you are elected, you will be a member of the Missouri Housing Development Commission, which issues low-income housing tax credits. You know full well how controversial that issue is as a former member of the Greitens administration. Would you push to make any changes either to that board or to that incentive if you are elected attorney general?
I think the single best thing we could do for the MHDC is actually getting elected leaders off of that board. I don't think it makes sense that the governor, the lieutenant governor, the treasurer, the attorney general sit as voting members of that commission. I'd much rather see a professional staff and people who are experienced in housing and construction and finance making decisions based on what's best for Missouri as opposed to what's best for their political constituencies or frankly, their donors, which we've seen repeatedly in the history of that commission. To me, LIHTC can be a powerful tool for good. I think that we need more and better housing in this state. We've heard from people all over the state that we need more affordable housing. I think MHDC can serve a valuable role. I think its politicization is unfortunate. And if there were any legislation I would propose to reform MHDC, it would include that provision, pulling the elected leaders off that board, because I just don't think they belong there.
Bailey has faced some scrutiny around representing three senators over tweets regarding the shooting at the Kansas City Chiefs parade. Would you have represented them if you were attorney general?
So I want to make two points there. First of all, I think the defamation suits against these senators are totally baseless, and they shouldn't have been brought. I think it's harassing, vexatious litigation that's highly, highly political. I don't think that they should have been represented by the state here. I think these were statements made in their private, not in their official capacity. And I think Andrew Bailey's argument that we need to protect Missouri jurisdiction and defend them because this case was brought in Kansas, which he said repeatedly, just doesn't make any sense. Missouri courts exercise jurisdiction over out-of-state defendants all the time, and out-of-state courts exercise jurisdiction over Missouri defendants all the time. That's a choice of law and a choice of forum question that plays out in courtrooms across America literally every day. I think actually on this point, Governor Parson's quite right. The taxpayer dollars shouldn't be going to fund a private defense or potentially to pay a private judgment in these cases. But I would just emphasize that I do believe that these defamation lawsuits are absolutely baseless. I don't think the senators did anything that was particularly wrong. They were commenting on a rapidly developing news story. They based their comments on what other people, including, I believe, a sitting congressman from Tennessee, had already said online. So I think these suits are baseless, and I hope they're speedily dismissed.
You had mentioned at the beginning of the show about so-called gray machines, which are machines you find in gas stations or fraternal halls that look like slot machines and I guess kind of are slot machines, but they are structured different than slot machines. So would you proactively go after businesses that have those machines in there, or would you go after the gray machine companies if you're attorney general, or is that just something you would have to look at the facts before deciding to insert your office into that?
So I think we need to be very clear about what's going on. And as I said before, we've driven all over the state. I've been on the road a lot over the last year and a half. You walk into any gas station in the state, you see these machines. I'd actually disagree with your characterization of them. They are slot machines. The supposed rationale for why they're legal under Missouri law, there have been two stated rationales. One is the so-called pre-reveal function.
That's what I was referring to, by the way.
The other is the fact that supposedly some of these machines don't have a built-in randomizer. I've reviewed Missouri gaming law. I've looked at this issue quite closely, and I don't believe that either of those two legal rationales hold any water whatsoever. So I think the situation that we have right now is that there are tens of thousands of illegal slot machines that are being allowed to operate, that are, I believe, depriving the state of Missouri of significant revenue. I think it's just a crazy situation, and it goes to show how when politically powerful constituencies are at work, the laws of Missouri are not being evenly enforced, and I think that's just wrong. The Missouri Attorney General's office does have some authority over Missouri gambling law. I would look to enforce the law, and I think really on just about any issue, that's how I would approach being Attorney General, making sure that the law is being enforced.
In the last few minutes, I do want to go back to your representation of Trump. We are recording this, I don't even remember what day it is. It's so hot, I've lost.
It is Thursday, June 27th. It is 4:18 p.m.
Thank you. So the decision on the immunity in the quote-unquote election interference case will probably be decided after this podcast comes out. You've been involved in that case, and I want you kind of to explain the case for presidential immunity and what you and John Sauer, who used to be Solicitor General here, are laying out.
Yeah, so John and I have been working on this presidential immunity issue since last summer. It was one of the first issues we worked on for President Trump at the district court level in D.C. We've handled the appeals of this issue in front of the D.C. Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court. I think let's talk history here for a second. In 1983, the Supreme Court in Nixon v. Fitzgerald recognized the idea of absolute civil immunity for presidents, that for their official acts in office, not their private conduct, but for their official acts in office, you cannot sue a president of the United States. This is a really important precedent. Without that, what you would see is anybody who thought they were harmed by any presidential act would be filing lawsuits all over the country, potentially in politically hostile jurisdictions. It would be impossible to be president with the specter of this sort of civil liability hanging over your head. We believe that that argument applies even more so in the criminal context. And we believe that the system our framers set up was one, I mean, this is the text of the Constitution, the Executive Vesting Clause, the Impeachment Judgment Clause, that absent impeachment and conviction by the House and Senate, you cannot criminally prosecute a president for their official acts in office. Now, again, this doesn't apply to private conduct. If a president walks out onto the street and shoots a man dead, he doesn't have immunity for that. Ulysses S. Grant was actually criminally prosecuted for illegal carriage racing in Washington, D.C. while he was president. So we're not, it's a great story, by the way. We're not talking about private conduct, but for a president's official acts in office, we believe that a failure by the court to recognize a broad doctrine of immunity would cripple the presidency. This is a case that goes beyond President Trump. It speaks to the core of the separation of powers and of our constitutional system. You can't have a situation where presidents are held at risk or threatened with the specter of criminal prosecution for making the very tough decisions that a president routinely has to make when they're in office.
Now, I think that John Sauer in particular got a lot of media attention when the whole hypothetical of can a president order SEAL Team 6 to kill a political rival would be an official act. Can you just talk about that? Because I read it and I was pretty alarmed by it, but maybe there's some context around it.
So this is a classic, almost political gotcha question that I think has unfairly tarred what we're arguing and what we're trying to do.
Which is why I'm asking you about it.
An order that the president gives to his military, I mean, that's a quintessential exercise of presidential authority. Now, if the president were to order SEAL Team 6 to kill a political opponent, that would be an illegal act. Everybody who participated in that act could be criminally prosecuted, and you would hope that the president would be speedily impeached and convicted, at which point he too would be able to be criminally prosecuted. But the system that our founders set up, I mean, James Wilson, James Madison, Chief Justice Marshall, and Marbury v. Madison, they were very clear that for a president's official acts in office, criminal prosecution just isn't on the table absent impeachment and conviction.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on Politically Speaking, and we are hoping to have Attorney General Bailey on in the coming weeks. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. And Will, how could people follow you on the World Wide Web or any place on social media where you want to be found?
The World Wide Web. That's like a throwback to the mid-1990s. Search me on Ask Jeeves. No, you can find our website at voteschaarf.com, VOTESCHARF.com. And you can find me on X, formerly known as Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Truth Social at Will Scharf. I've been a longtime fan of the podcast. It's great to be here with you guys. Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you. Until next time, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.